Welcome to Conversations About Running, the podcast from Running Trips. Today's guest is Kevin Seward. Kevin is a two-time Olympic marathon runner, having competed for Ireland in both the Rio and Tokyo Games. With a 2:10 marathon PB, Kev can count himself amongst the finest marathoners in Europe. But what's different about Kev is that he's also a full-time teacher. Kev, or should that be Mr. Seward, describes himself as an educator first and a runner second. And in today's podcast, we discuss various aspects of competing as an elite athlete whilst balancing a career as an assistant principal, a career that Kev takes just as seriously as his running. So sit back and enjoy our conversation with two-time Olympian Kevin Seward. Kev, thanks for joining us.
Anytime. It's great to be on the show today.
For people who don't know who you are, do you want to do just a sort of a quick rundown and let people know what a hero and superstar they're listening to, or shall I give a brief synopsis of your glorious career?
We can both do it, can't we? So I can introduce myself. I'm Kevin Seward. I'm a marathon runner and assistant principal of the school in Leicester. I recently ran a PB in the marathon of 2:10. I've been in the game for quite some time now, and hopefully still making progress.
So I mean, that's an interesting thought to go down straight away, is that you introduce yourself as a 2:10 marathon runner and an assistant head teacher. That's a fairly unusual combination.
It's certainly a strange combination, isn't it? I probably should have done it the other way around. I probably consider myself to be an assistant principal and then a 2:10 marathon runner. Pedantic, so I guess, in either way. But yeah, there's not many. I don't know that there's many. Certainly haven't come across many people who work full time in education and run marathons as well.
Is that a bit of an oxymoron though? Full time education.
Some might say that. And invite those people to come and join me for a day. They're more than welcome to shadow me. But yes, I guess in terms of professions, it's probably one of the better ones to do as a marathon runner. I mean, if I was working physical jobs all day, it's definitely a different type of tiredness. But squeezing it in around planning and working and teaching, it's definitely a lot easier when you're office based or school based than maybe if you're on a building site or something a bit more manual.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely was joking. I mean, at the end of the day, you're putting in. Yeah, I think it's interesting also that you say you would view yourself as a teacher first and a runner second. I mean, I don't want to set it up and make these questions like too easy for you. But what's the key, or what's the process that you've gone through that's allowed you to run at such a high level whilst also combining it with a full time career? Because that in itself is definitely fairly unusual.
Yeah, there's some irony in it that the when I started teaching, I actually became a little bit better at running. It's an oddity, isn't it? So when I moved to Loughborough back in 2008 to do my teacher training, I came as a runner. Like, I'd been running all the way through school. I'm not going to make this into some pretend story that I didn't run and suddenly started running marathons. It's not necessarily that. But when I arrived in Loughborough in 2008, I certainly wasn't competing much, if at all. Did my PGC year and got a job at a local high school. A year or two later, I moved roles to assistant principal, so it was very quick in that sort of that promotion. But once I got promoted, it was around about 2014, I started to run a little bit better. Ran a first marathon in 2015, and then qualified for Tokyo or for Rio in 2016. So it was very, very strange that the last time I spent thinking about running, the last time I had to sort of engross myself in all things to do with running, the better I got.
Yeah, so this is something I wanted to talk about a little bit later, but it seems like the right time for it to come up. Do you remember in 2013 when I was back from Kenya for 5 or 6 weeks, and I was living in, what is it, Woodlands Drive? Do you remember when we were briefly roommates?
The famous number 46, of course. Is some athletes have passed through that house.
Yeah, haven't they? Just unfortunately, I'm not one of the better ones of them. But So I mean, you may have already kind of pre-answered this question by saying it's when you started teaching and kind of running almost became less of a big deal. You allowed you to become better at it. But what I really wanted to know, so when we were living together, you were training, living together, like, you know, when I was essentially a lodger in your house for a few weeks.
So I met you and I knew you as someone who was training seriously, but I didn't get the impression from you that you were, not that you weren't serious, but that you weren't really putting yourself out there as sort of someone who was trying to compete in, at an elite level. And then a couple of years later, it started to some pretty serious performances.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty fair analogy. So I think it's important to point out that I did always run, and even back then when we were roomies, I was running a fair amount. I ran every day. I love running. I loved it, the idea of being out there and just kind of lacing up your shoes and getting going and forgetting the whatever's happened in your day. It's a nice catharsis, a nice release. So I did. I ran quite a lot. I wouldn't say I trained necessarily. And I think when I met Andy Hobdell the end of 2014, start of 2015, we made that quite clear distinction that I'd been doing a lot of running, but not a lot of training for quite some time before that.
So what would typically your runs kind of consist of during that time when you didn't necessarily consider it training as such? Were you literally just going out for kind of and running however you felt like on the day kind of thing? So you weren't doing any like interval training or, you know, specific marathon training or anything like that, just heading out and running?
Yeah, I kind of did what was going. I kind of asked around and got a feel for what people were doing. So if it felt like something I'd fancy doing that day, then I'd do it. So some days I'd run two sessions, three sessions back to back. Other weeks I would do no sessions and just run every day because there was someone running every day. So I very much just kind of bought into what was going around at the time, and what sort of took my attention or who I wanted to run with, and what they were doing, rather than anything necessarily planned. So I wouldn't say no, I didn't do any intervals or I didn't do any tempos, but there was certainly no consistency in it. It was just whatever was happening, and I was keen to do that.
Yeah, so it wasn't necessarily planned or programmed. It was just whatever you felt like, really.
Whatever I felt like. If I woke up that day and somebody said they were doing a tempo, I'd go join. And if I woke up and they said there was a couple of easy runs going, and that's just how I felt like, what I felt like doing that day, then I went and did it. But I guess if I look back, in some weird way, I was building a really good base that was going to stand me in better stead later on.
I was just going to kind of say that, really, like, even though at the time it probably didn't feel like training, looking back on it now, well, yeah, you've kind of already answered the question. I was going to say, looking back on it now, do you feel like, although it didn't feel like training at the time, could you look at it and say, actually, it was pretty decent, you know, a pretty decent foundation?
I think it was exactly that. It really did build that sort of robust base. And I think one of my strengths really now, touch wood, is that I am relatively robust. And I wonder how much of that was because I put back weeks and months and probably years of relatively solid mileage on top of solid mileage without really forcing the issue too much. And sometimes it was weeks of easy running, and sometimes it was weeks of sessions. So really building that base and allowing the body and the muscles to kind of develop and adjust and adapt indirectly, because it certainly wasn't my plan ever at that stage. I didn't, if Gavin had asked me in number 46, did I ever see myself running the marathon, I'd have laughed. It certainly wasn't my plans then.
So is that then specifically happened when you did start working with Andy Hobdell, or did that then evolve over time beyond that?
So ironically, no, it was just before I started working with Andy. I again joined in, I think it was with Beattie and Craig and some of the other Loughborough, famous Loughborough alumni, but to train for Manchester Marathon. And
so you were potentially following my program then, if you were doing Craggy and Beattie training.
Yeah, very potentially.
What year are we talking?
We're actually, I said 2015 already. I think that was actually 2014.
European 2014 Manchester Marathon.
So
I coached you. I coached you to your first marathon.
You coached me to my first marathon, my first championships, definitely.
How's that working, Gavin?
What would be interesting is that I do have a 10% lifetime policy that all my athletes are part of.
10% of everything.
Yeah, 10% of life earnings, whether it's from running or non-running.
I can remember signing that contract, actually. I can remember signing that. It would have been with the boys then. So again, it was very much just jumping out with what they were doing, right up to sort of Manchester. And then I went and ran Manchester. I was originally going to help one of the boys out, but from what I remember, they didn't start. So a couple of weeks before they got injured and didn't start. So I was like, oh, well, I'm entered. I'm going to go and just give it a go and see how it goes. And I can remember the race starting and one of the guys, I think it was Andy Jones or something, just taking off up the road. So I just thought, well, I'll hang with these guys in the next group for as long as I can. And before you knew it, it was 20 miles in and somebody was handing me pick and mix because I didn't have any gels. It was a fun experience.
Did you have an idea at that point what sort of shape stuff of where you'd been compared to others in training?
I knew I was going well in the longer runs. Intervals were always a difficulty. Like, I just wasn't maybe as quick as they were naturally. So I knew that I could run long. I could run, you know, I'd go and do a 20 miler around the infamous or famous 2K loop, and I felt quite strong with those. So I knew it was in pretty good shape. I knew I would get to 20 miles in the marathon anyway without really maybe too much worries. But it was what I wasn't prepared for was what would happen after that.
Which was?
I can remember getting to 23 and just thinking, like, right now, if I sat down on the side of the road, nobody would even notice. It was a world of pain. But I then remember just thinking at that stage, like, mile at a time. And you just picked it off one by one, just mile at a time. But I think what kept me going was I was actually in third place at that stage. And I thought there could be nothing worse than dropping out of the race when you're in third place, when there's people busting the gut behind you. So you got to keep going.
Yeah, yeah. Was it being filmed or anything?
No, thankfully not. But my wife now, she wasn't my wife then, was there, and her family were there, so I felt obliged to get.
Was that the first year of Manchester Marathon?
No, I think it was the year after I came back. I think Dave Norman won it the year before. Okay. Potentially, it was the year after I came back. So it was in its second sort of return year.
So then did you finish that race and then think? You know, there seems to be two ways that it can go when people finish their first marathon. They either can't wait to sign up for the next one, or they're telling anyone who listen that it's once and never again.
Well, I ran the last 3 miles going, this is horrific, this is terrible, I'm never doing this again. Crossed the finish line and thought, well, wouldn't mind doing one of those again. So maybe that's just the normal reaction. No, I finished and thought, I'd definitely give it another go at some stage in the future. I just wasn't sure quite how soon that would be. It turned out it was 4 months later.
What time did you run at marathon at Manchester?
I ran 2:18, 2:18:40s, what something. And yes, before anyone points out the obvious, that was one of the years that was short. So,
I
was happy.
Yeah, just out of interest, by how much?
I think they changed the times, didn't they? Just converted the times. It was about 2:20. Okay. So, it was a decent amount, I guess, but it got me the 2:18 got me a discretionary pick for Europeans that year, so it was handy.
So was that in your mind going into that race? I could run for Ireland, or
never know. Right. No, definitely not at that stage. I even when I'd finished it wasn't a consideration. It wasn't until sort of a week or so later that I got a phone call saying we're going to send a team to the team champs at Europeans, and would you like to come along and sort of get a bit of experience out there. So no, it was never in my mind at all. So I was delighted when that did happen.
So then was it around then that you then hooked up with Andy Hopdell?
No, so I then used your training again to sorry, I just
very, that's very twice, good of me.
That's twice I owed you, yeah. I then used your similar
you're gonna have to be careful now though when I ask you in a few minutes. So when you started working with Hobdell for the first time, what did he think of your previous training? you're gonna have to be a little bit careful with how you answer that.
Yeah, he said it was amazing. So yeah, I followed a similar sort of program and got a few additional runs and stuff off Runner's World of all places.
Did you really?
Yeah, I went on and sort of googled the internet and had a little look around and found bits and pieces of programs, things they add in, just to kind of increase volume a little bit. And I think I got up over 100 miles a week and stuff like that. So I did increase the long run, that sort of stuff, and went to Zurich for the European champs.
Gavin, you're going to have to just explain to me quickly what you mean by when you're saying that Kev's following your programs.
Oh, sorry. When he was saying that he jumps in with some other runners.
Yeah.
Before Manchester, the two runners that he jumps in were two runners that I was coaching.
Ah, I see. Okay. Who were they?
John Beattie and Luke Craig.
Ah, okay. And you were coaching them at the time.
Yeah.
And I was sandbagging.
It's kind of the other way around. I just kept getting these reports from John, like, yeah, Kev keeps turning up. If he wants to pace us through marathon sessions, all good. Yeah,
crack on. Yeah,
yeah. Stops me having to do the work.
So was that the first time you two met, was when you were moved into his place?
Yeah, so I came back from Kenya for about 5 or 6 weeks to do some races.
So that was when you were living in Kenya?
Yes. Yeah, so okay. this was 20, did we say 2013, Kev? Is that what we decided?
I think it was, yeah, it must have been around 2013.
Oh, I'll tell you when it was. What year was Moscow World Champs?
Oh, this is a good
Is that 2013 or 2015?
This is a question we should all be able to answer, isn't it?
Google knows.
I can hear some clicking.
Who's going to get there first? Moscow 2013.
I think a better way of remembering it is you. I think you finished top 15 at National Cross. So what year was that?
Yeah, no, 2020. I was either 21st or 22nd at National Cross. Yeah, that was fun because I'm pretty sure you and Boardman, who was in the house, had no idea that I was actually like. I think that was the first weekend that I was there. I then went up to Sunderland and came 20. I can't remember. It's either 21st or 22nd. And yeah, then I was like, you know what Boardman's like? Like I was like, oh, well done, mate.
Yeah. don't give too much of a compliment, just in case.
So Kev, it was definitely 2013 because I was coaching Gladys and I was back. Her world championship race was whilst I was back.
Yeah, so in 2013 then. So yeah.
Yeah.
So that was when you kind of started taking it more seriously, Kev, the marathon training.
Probably just after European. So I went and did Zurich, which I'm not sure if anyone listening ran that marathon or looked at the course, but I just can remember running up a hill with kettlebells and thinking you needed a vernacular to get to the top of it. And I hadn't done any, at that stage, I hadn't done any research or anything on the course. So I showed up and was like, what on earth is this? We've got to run up there four times. And I hadn't really looked at what was worse if you had to come back down it, the other side. So I was thinking, like, you really should have looked at this. So when I was there, I roomed with another Irish marathoner, Paul Pollock, who had moved to London and was being coached by Andy Hobdell at the time. So Paul put in a good word with Andy and said, this guy might need a little bit of direction.
Might need a little bit of direction. He's turned up to the European champs without having done any serious training and doesn't know the course.
and wasn't even experienced enough to realize that there was a website that showed you what the course looked like. when we went up that hill in the vernacular, I just remember just thinking, I'm in the wrong place. I need to go, get myself back home. So he introduced me to Andy Hobdell then, just after that. And so that would have been the end of 2014. And we kind of got the plan moving forward from there.
Yeah, okay, nice. I'm going to go back to Gavin's question now, which is, what did Andy think of your, like, the way you've been training up until that point?
Well, in the longer term picture, so not just the previous weeks and before the marathon, he was like, well, it's clear you can run a lot. It's clear that you can run easy and you can run long, but we're not sure if you can run fast, and that's what it's going to take. If you want to go to Rio or you want to go run fast in a marathon, then we need to check whether or not you can run quick over the shorter distances as well. So he said pretty much what I said earlier on, in terms of, you've got a solid base, you've been able to run mileage, aerobically you're going to be quite strong, but that's maybe not always enough to run a good marathon. So let's see if you can actually train like a marathon or not. So we spent most of that year in the 2014 to start of 2015, sort of looking at trying to run a little bit on the track without doing too much, and trying to run maybe a faster half marathon. Like I'd run 68 minutes or something for the half before that. So it was like, let's try and run a little bit quicker in the half first and work around some 10K based stuff as well. And then we'll go run Berlin in September 2015.
Give us some of your times then for the shorter stuff, 5K, 10K, that kind of thing.
So at the time, when I was working with Andy around about then, I'd run around their recent performances. So if it's something in a recent time when I was running around them, around about 30 mid, so 30, something like that.
Yeah.
And 68 for the half. So Andy was like, we need to definitely get those moving a bit quicker. And I joked at the time, we need to make that 30-30 a marathon split. And it was probably, you know, you're dreaming at that stage of ever making that a marathon split. So I went and ran a half marathon PB around 65 and ran sub 30 a couple of times. And that was kind of this, maybe I ran just inside 14:20 as well for 5K in the track. So it was like, right, okay, now we're ready to start thinking about running quicker at the marathon.
It's quite interesting because all the people, I myself am a middle distance runner. So all the people I know who've kind of moved up to the marathon have done it pretty much the opposite way. They've come from like a come from a 5K, 10K track background and then had to start adding the longer stuff, the longer runs, the working on that, the endurance side of things to try and get to the marathon. But you've kind of come at it from the opposite direction, almost from having a really strong aerobic base and then having to go, right, okay, I've got to kind of speed up a little bit here to get to the faster end of the races.
Well, that's exactly what I guess that base building phase was. At school, like as a schoolboy athlete, I'd make our school finals and ran sub 15 in the track for 5K. And so I had run quick relatively in the past, but it'd just been that long, that big gap in between where I hadn't. So I can remember going and running a 5K in one of the local parks here, and I'd be like a park run before park run came to Leicester.
Right.
And running 15:40 and thinking, wow, like that was hard work. So it was hard. Yeah, definitely. And it was kind of, that was the start of really trying to move things forward a bit. Just hang on, saying 15:40 was quite difficult, and that's kind of where you are. Accepting that's where you are, and then sort of making the changes to move on and get things moving quickly.
Yeah. So are you still on quite high mileage at this point as well? Sort of like more than 100 miles a week while still trying to work on that kind of the faster end of stuff as well?
No. Well, once I went to Andy, he moved a lot of the run distances back and sped things up a little bit. So I would have done a lot of running around, I mean, relative speaking, but around 7 minute pace. And then sessioned in around it. Whereas when I started with Andy, he was like, right, okay, let's cut some of the running back and let's start running a little bit faster. So we started bringing in, you'd run an easy 5 in the morning and you'd do 5 in 30 minutes in the evening. So 6 minute type pace. And on a Wednesday, you'd do 10 and 60 instead of running an easy 10 miles. So little tweaks to run a little bit quicker in training and allowing your recovery days to happen as well, but just speeding things up a little bit and reducing the volume all around. Kind of that approach.
I just want to make sure, I really just want to make sure that you don't get kind of misled here a little bit, Callum, because I think if you then follow this for another couple of years, all this volume's coming back.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think that's, if we're going to talk about that journey now, then the volume comes back. It definitely does. So it was kind of getting your body moving quicker, first of all, but with enough volume that you weren't tipping the scales. So you had to get the body moving quicker, you needed to move it back in terms of volume. We certainly couldn't do both. Sure. until you got to a point where you could start adding that volume back in, but maintain some of that intensity. And then that was kind of building the picture back up again. So we moved right back up towards when you're in a marathon phase, running 115, 120 miles a week.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. So I guess when you first moved to Andy Hobdall, it was more, he was more asking what's important right now. And at that moment in time, the mileage wasn't the focus really, because that wasn't what you were, I mean, you already had that was your strengths, one of your strengths. So the I guess the focus was then to work on the speed, and then, like you said, add the volume back in later once you knew you could operate a little bit faster.
Absolutely. That so it was kind of identifying what were the weaknesses at that stage, and what were the strengths. And it wasn't letting the strengths entirely go, because you can still get confidence from a lot of that sort of stronger stuff. So every so often you would drop in a longer run or would do a longer tempo just to remind yourself, just give yourself that confidence again that's what I was good at the time. I wasn't particularly good at running 400s or running a little bit quicker in runs, but I was very good at running longer a little bit faster. But
yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because my coach often I'll be doing like tempo runs and long runs, and then my coach will often give me some just 400 meter reps to make myself feel good.
Yeah, just to remind yourself that it's there, that's your strength. We're not ignoring it. We're just kind of working on something different for now.
So when you started building this mileage back on, how did you see I guess you're now moving into more of a marathon specific phase. So how did that change your race program, I guess? Did you then start targeting a specific marathon?
Ironically, in 2015, strangely, we got word that the Berlin Marathon was going to be kind of an unofficial Irish Olympic trial for Rio. So Paul, who'd been working with Andy for a few years at this stage, was going to go there. So Andy said, let's just piggyback off that. Let's go along and see how things go out there. So,
Kev, sorry, before you carry on, I just want to ask you, now that you've got to this point in time and you've run internationally and you started training at a higher level with Andy, in your mind, are you now starting to think of yourself as an elite athlete? Are you starting to think, like people are talking to you about going to the Olympic Games. You're talking about going to Berlin Marathon. I'm presuming that's as an elite athlete rather as an invited elite athlete. You can tell us whether that's the case or not, sort of, or are you still this guy who just does a bit of running and it's sort of like, oh, hang on, I'm starting to get quite fast here.
I'm still that guy. I'm still that guy, I think. But no, at that time, no, I was, I mean, when Andy mentioned Berlin, I nearly spat my coffee out, which I don't do often. Like, it was frightening. Let's go to Berlin Marathon. I was like, that's the one I watched on TV. It's amazing. Like, how are we going to get in there? So luckily, some people did Dublin Marathon, Irish Marathon Mission, were able to pull some strings and get me in. I was kind of one of the guys running around without the name on the bib. So that wasn't my first time getting my name on the bib at a marathon. So, yeah.
But were you there as an elite athlete though? Like, you weren't just in the mass field, you're in the elite.
Yeah, so Berlin's really good in terms of they have elite and they have sub-elite, and the sub-elite offers is really helpful. So I got to stay the night before in the hotel, which was the first time probably ever at a race, aside from European champs. And I got some drinks on the table. But of course, in Manchester, I hadn't used drinks and hadn't used gels or anything. So it was all quite novel. Again, Google came in, had a look at Google, asked around, asked some people, spoke to another one of your athletes at the state at that time, Lee Marion.
Yeah, Lee was there, wasn't he? Yeah.
Spoke to Lee about what I should do with drinks and where they should go and how I should use them. So
you beat Lee that day, didn't you?
Lee was a great help that day. Yeah, we kind of ran together for a lot of it that marathon, and he was talking me through the early stages of it. You know, like not panicking, and there I was, like my half marathon PB going into there was, I'd run 65 at that stage, but once, and so my other half marathon time was around 68. And the race goes off at a quicker pace than that in my group. So I was beginning to panic quite early on. He was like, don't worry about it. You're fine. You're good where you are. We had a good big group of people at that time. So it was all I certainly wasn't considering myself a potential for the Olympics at that stage. And I certainly wasn't considering myself to be an elite runner.
I mean, at some point though, that mindset must have shifted. I know you're playing it down. You're like, oh, you know, I'm still... And that's great. No, I'm not saying you need to think of yourself as big time or anything, but there must have come a point where you're like, okay, I'm going to Berlin Marathon. I'm in the elite hotel. I'm running guys who I've watched on telly, or you know, you know who these people are. There must have been a time where I started to think, okay, this is even if you didn't think, okay, this is really serious, you must have thought this is pretty cool.
I definitely thought it was pretty cool. I was sat in the athlete briefing. The morning of the day before the race, and they were bringing up the splits and what people were going to run, and I thought this was incredible that these guys are going to run that fast. But yeah, at that stage I wasn't at the stage where I was ready to accept that I was in the elite field, and that was where I was. My mind at that stage was still to try and run a faster time than I'd done before. So
were you a full-time teacher at this point as well?
Yeah, so I was teaching full-time. So I flew out on the We were flying out on the Friday afternoon and arriving in the Friday night, and then doing the briefing on the Saturday morning, racing Sunday, and rushing back to the airport, hobble into school on the Monday morning. So it was all surreal.
Did your colleagues understand that you were sort of competing at a high level in sport, or was it just like, oh, Kev's doing Berlin Marathon?
Very much that. Yeah, he's doing Berlin Marathon. I think they knew that, obviously, because I told them I'd run 218 / 220, whatever it was in the end. But so they knew that, certainly compared to the guys in work who were running at that stage, I was probably relatively good, pretty good. That's probably a fair description, and that I could run a bit. But I think they certainly weren't expecting me to come back and say I might have qualified for the Rio Olympics.
So when you do arrive to something like, perhaps this is even still the case now, when you arrive out to, let's use two examples if we can. So let's say the Berlin Marathon 2015, when it's still sort of fairly early in your career, and then also let's take is it Seville or Valencia you did?
Seville. Yeah.
So then Seville. When you arrive at those races, you might know as a fact, I'm going to say, do you get the impression, but do you get the impression that you're the only person there who isn't a, if not a pro runner, but someone who, for whom running is sort of their number one? thing? Like is there anyone else there who's a full-time worker who runs either side of that?
No, I wouldn't. I do, like, when I look around and I speak to some of the guys out there, I know a few marathoners around Europe that I'd speak to who work part-time, and some of them are even part-time doctors, so they work as medics, so they've obviously done all their training and everything, so, which is no doubt very taxing. But in terms of working full-time, I wouldn't have come across many that are certainly getting on the plane as soon as they can on a Sunday afternoon and rushing back for school first thing on a Monday morning. So I do think it's quite novel, but I bet there's probably people listening now who are going to reply saying, I do that, and it's great, and it is great. And the distraction helps, I think.
So, okay, let's go down that route then. You say the distraction helps, and I can appreciate that, and I can understand that. And we've spoken on this podcast before about the psychology that comes along with some of these things. But what about the other side? What about the fact that when your rivals are training at 9 in the morning and then sleeping all afternoon, training at 4 and then being done for the day at 6, how does that... Well, one, does that have a negative effect on your psychology that they're sort of getting an advantage over you? And then two, I'd like to spend a little bit of time, if you can just sort of give us an idea of what is a typical day in the life for you, like when you're in full training.
Yeah, is it negative on my psychology? No and yes. I think it's kind of going to sit in the fence with that a little bit. So most days of the week, it isn't, but there are those days in the middle of a marathon block where I'm tired, I've been training until late the night before, and I've got to get up early the next morning and train again before school. It's dark, it's raining, those sort of days where people motivation might be challenged anyway. I've questioned the choices in the past a few times, and thinking some people have it, and I'm reticent to use the term, but some people have it easier than I do. But then when you're finished that session, you just feel that little bit tougher, so it has the opposite effect. I'm thinking, if I can do it today, then I can do it and any other day. If it, on a good day, on a sunny day, on a warm day, at 9 o'clock, at whatever, then so the motivation kind of is the opposite in sometimes. I'm not going to say I'm not challenged by it. I definitely am. I'm not going to say that sometimes I don't find it really difficult. I'd love to be out there at 9 o'clock and not out there at 5:45 a.m. or whatever. So yeah, sometimes it definitely would have me thinking about how different would it be if I didn't work full time, if I just ran full time. But most of the times I started by saying I'm an assistant principal and then a runner. And I think I always relate it back to how much I enjoy doing what I do. And that helps a lot.
So what about things like rest and recovery? Is that something you have no choice in the matter? You have no choice in, or is it something you have to maximize when the opportunity does arrive?
I think it's the latter. I think it's definitely maximizing the opportunities when they come. So I'm big into, like, I sleep well. Maybe not as well as I could, but I'm definitely in bed relatively early and I'm up early, so I'm very good at getting sleep. I look for a minimum of 8 hours, which is quite tight on a teacher schedule sometimes, but I certainly do my best to get a minimum of 8 hours, and I've spent as little time, so I'm teaching, I'm on my feet, I'm moving around, I'm on my feet, but when the opportunities come to sort of sit down and I make sure I'm getting plenty of good food throughout the day. So I do maximize the opportunities I do have rather than sort of miss the opportunities that I don't.
So can you just give us a brief outline of, like, what is a typical day in your life?
Yeah, so I guess most of the year it is like everyone else, you know, at all levels, kind of running before and after work a little bit. But probably the most exciting bit to talk about is probably during a marathon phase. So it wouldn't be atypical, but during a marathon phase, we're talking 16-week blocks. So it becomes... If you do two of those a year, it does end up becoming the norm, doesn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
So during a marathon block, if we're doing a special block day, which we do probably a couple of times in a 16-week block, it could mean a session in the morning. So you'd be up at 5 a.m., get some coffee and some water, changed, and out the door for a warm-up. So it could be...
And would that be it? You'd go out without, you wouldn't take on any food. You just go coffee, water, let's go.
Coffee, water, go. Yeah. So no food. I don't think there's a big enough gap, really. I would still have to be alone up at 5. We'd still have to be out the door for 5:30, 5:45. So wouldn't really be enough time to eat much. And then it's kind of a good training effect by the fact you have to do it rather than by choice or by necessity. So yeah, out the door, warm up. And it could be 13.1 at, I don't know, 5.20s or 5.15 pace. And then back shard, chains, porridge in a pot. Heather's great. She has the porridge ready in the car and bolted in the work. So there'd be, then you'd be in work, you'd be working most of the day. And then if it's
bolt it into below the speed limit.
Below the speed limit. Absolutely below the speed limit. Yeah, always below the speed limit.
But that was worth clarifying.
Clarifying, yes. It's 8 miles of city roads. You're definitely not going any quicker than the than the speed limit, thankfully. And then in the evening, say it was a 10K at just inside marathon pace, you'd come home again, out the door, 6 PM, 6:30 PM, warm up and run your 10K hot at marathon effort or just inside, then back home you come, dinner, bed, and that was kind of the cycle. Or dinner, and if you've got work, it's a tough period of time and you've got work to do, then dinner, a bit of work, and then bed. So that would be a special block is an extreme version. So most other days would be, you know, I'd run to work, I'd get showered, I'd get breakfast in school, and then I'd run home from work. So use work as part of the commute, which saves a lot of time.
So what does that mean, all the kind of the extra bits that you see runners doing, they're just not an option for you? Like, you know, gym stuff, massage stuff, rolling around on the floor with a hockey ball. You know, where does all that kind of thing fit into your
I'm laughing and joking because I probably had my first massage in 2016, first proper massage 2016 out in Rio, and it was kind of, that was where I was with that sort of side of things. So it doesn't feature as highly maybe as it does in other people's programs, but now I've started to incorporate a whole lot more. Over the last sort of 12 months, we built the gym in the garage. So we converted the garage and built the gym, put lots of equipment in there, and it's starting to become a more prominent sort of role. I probably try to get in twice a week. I'm not sure how that compares to what other people do, but I've got a nice program that's been set, and it lasts sort of, I've asked for it to last no more than sort of 30-40 minutes, because if it's too much, then I'm probably more likely to not do it. Whereas if it's short, simple, and a bit more achievable, then I will do it. In terms of massage, I try to get in once a week, but I think Gabs knows as much as anyone else does that doesn't always happen. I try my best, is probably the honest answer, but certainly the rolling around the ground and that sort of thing that you
I mean, should we clarify what you mean by that? Because that might just sound a bit weird, like I'm monitoring when you go for massage.
Yeah, so I've got a tracker on me, and every time I go, Gav gets a notification. No, Gav lives next door to our brilliant masseuse, James. So I wave in through the window at my patio on the way by.
I just want to touch on one compared to lots of other runners who I know for a fact are always kind of on power of 10, looking at other athletes' performances and seeing how others are getting on. And you know, I mean, myself as a runner, I'm very, I wouldn't say obsessed, but I'm very interested in how other runners are doing in my category. You know, I'm always looking at their times and what training they're doing and stuff like that. And not necessarily because I think, oh, I have to do what they're doing, I have to do more than what they're doing, but just almost out of interest. But it does add pressure. And I think one thing that strikes me about your training and the way you train from what you've described is you're very focused on yourself and not too concerned about what other people are doing. And I think that's a really just nice way of training, to be honest. Like, it's, you know, you kind of take the pressure off yourself a little bit, and it sounds like you just kind of, you want to improve your performance, and wherever that takes you, that's where it takes you.
I think that's pretty much spot on. I think it's about being that little bit better in yourself and everything that you do, and if it leads to improvements, then that's fantastic. And I love to see people running well. I love to check when I see some results pop up and someone's run a really good marathon or a really good half marathon. I know there's a really good narrative behind that. I know they've been a lot of hard work and they've trained really hard. So it's always great if I see people doing really well. I'm delighted. But it very much doesn't impact on what I do, and I wouldn't do anything different as a result of other people's performances.
Yeah, it's one thing that as a coach I've been trying to kind of instill on a few of my athletes. They're very there's a few, I think if they're listening now they'll know that I'm talking about them, but they're very caught up in not necessarily comparing themselves to others, but comparing themselves to almost an arbitrary goal. So, you know, I have to run sub 3 hours, or I have to run this time, or, you know, they're kind of, they're putting a time or a specific goal on something. And I'm trying to say that the number one goal in running performance is to just improve, and every day to try and be a bit better, and to, you know, continue on the journey of improvement. And if that takes you to your goal, the ultimate goal, then great. If it doesn't, then, you know, you've still gone a long way on the journey, and you may even find, and often you'll find, that you surpassed that goal without even really thinking about it too much. Yeah, and I just think it's a much more pleasant way, really, of training.
It's a much more sort of athlete-centered approach to it, and kind of enjoying the process, and enjoying all those processes that come with it, because you can pick a win in everything you do every day, or you can pick a loss, and it's up to you to decide which one you opt for. And I think, you know, when you're enjoying it, and you're the process is something that you're engaged in and having fun with, then you're always going to feel like you're making those little improvements. Yeah.
So on that note then, Kev, as you have sort of become a bit more involved in the elite side, and you've been involved in and around the Irish Federation, have you had access to things like sports psychology, exercise physiology, any of the ologies, or is it still a very sort of simple and yeah, is it almost like you don't have time to worry about that, so you just do the running and you're done with it?
So they're all on offer. All of the ologies, as you put it, like I can see a sports psychologist, I can see a nutritionist, I can speak to physiologists and have testing, but it's very much, yeah, I just continue with doing what I'm doing. It's if I try to add extras in, then I think I might get to the stage where it's kind of tipping something somewhere. I mean, I made use of some physiology before going to Tokyo. So the lab here at Loughborough was fantastic, and did some heat acclimatization type stuff. But I could fit it in for, you know, the last couple of weeks before I went, because school was easing down. We're breaking up into the school holidays. So, but mostly the services there, Athletics Ireland have been absolutely brilliant. Athletics Northern Ireland as well have been fantastic. They've offered those services. But I still very much as I was in 2015 with regards to those.
So yeah. So were you still fully full time even in the build up?
Yeah, how many times are we going to ask?
Even in the build up to the Olympics.
Well, you were full time.
Yeah.
But up to the, that's mental.
Can you upload your timesheet, please, so we can
I broke up from school. Going a bit dates wrong. I broke off from school. I think it was a Friday, so around about the 13th or 14th of July, whatever that was. And then I flew back to Belfast to see my family before I went, and then went to Dublin, flew out to Tokyo. So pretty much I had about 3 or 4 days between finishing school and getting on the flight to Sapporo. To Fukuroi. So yeah, it wasn't long between finishing and going.
Yeah, students must have been losing their minds. Seeing the assistant head teacher on the TV running a marathon.
So I got for the first time, like, I got emails on the school email accounts from the kids emailing me from school, saying good luck beforehand, and then telling me that they stayed up to watch it, like, with their families. Yeah, I felt terrible because I was like, I had warned you beforehand, guys. Like, you might see me for the first
minutes. On that note, have you watched the footage back?
I haven't actually watched the footage back.
Okay, so I was watching, but, like, as you know, like, Jacob's, I think I watched it as live the next morning. But yeah, obviously with Jacob around, like, my attention isn't quite on the race for the entire sort of 2.5 hours. But from memory, the only time you were on screen was the first sort of 2 minutes of the race. And I mean, I don't know if you want to talk to people a little bit about Tokyo and how the race went, but If you weren't last, you were second last at that point.
Yeah, so I had a few difficulties before I went out, ironically. Talking about being robust, I had a few niggles in my quads and back heading out, which is unusual. So I had to be sensible in my race plan. So I was kind of saying, well, I've got a feeling my quads are going to, they're just hurting a bit too much in the build-up to the last couple of weeks. So I was like, I've got a feeling they're not going to maybe... They're not going to have their best day, so I've got to be sensible in how I start things. So the race went off, and they absolutely pegged it out, almost like it wasn't 30 degrees and 100% humidity. And I looked around. I think you're right. At one stage, I might have been last on the
road. Yeah, I mean, I just to clarify, I really didn't want to say, want to imply that there's anything shameful about being in that position. Like, no. Obviously, it's just, yeah, if kids have stayed, kids don't necessarily understand the level that you're at to be at that event and the level of the people around you that are running. So, yeah, they may have been, I don't know, a little bit miffed to say, oh, I thought he was good.
Well, to be fair to them, they didn't know. They didn't have a clue. They just saw me on TV. You know, it was like, we saw you on TV. It wasn't, they weren't bothered if it was first or last or middle. They didn't really care. They were there you were on TV. But I think, like, it's, you know, it went out super fast. I think a guy was dead last in the row, but was running sub 5:10 pace. You know, sub 2:15 marathon pace in 30 degrees heat, probably closer to 2:12, 2:13 pace and last in the road. And so it was an interesting moment where I was thinking, I'm kind of still running someone else's race. I want to go a little bit easier because my quads are hurting, but I didn't quite have the confidence to let the gaps grow too big because I knew I'd still want to work through. And I knew if you worked through sensibly, you could have gone from the back of the field to the top 30 very easily, top 25 in the second half, if you had kind of got that right. And I was beginning to think, you know, that my quads are still hurting. They're hurting after the first mile. They're not hurting any worse after the 10th mile. Maybe I'll be okay. And then that fell apart as well, which was fantastic. So,
where did you end up?
56.
So the reason I've had to ask that is because it appears that the Olympic Games are not a power of 10 ratified.
Oh.
Which is a bit of a strange one.
Strange, yeah. 56, I think I was around 56. So
in 2016, the Olympics was met whatever criteria power of 10 desire. But yeah, 2021.
Doesn't seem to be there. Yeah, so I think it was around 56, but I do remember, like, there was one stage I was passing massive groups of people, and I wasn't moving that well, but I was thinking, hold on, I'm obviously still moving okay. And then I got the mile 21 and my quads just, aerobically I felt great and my heart and lungs were in a brilliant place, but my quads had just gone at that stage. So it went from, yeah, you're feeling okay and moving through, and to right now, you're really just going to have to try and get to that finish line. And at that stage, I'd have dragged myself crawling if I had to. But thankfully, they stayed intact just enough to get across the finish line.
Is that essentially how you view the race there? Is it was just a case of, maybe other than the people who are up fighting for medals, it's a case of who can fall apart the least is going to finish the best?
Well, I kind of, like, I did have ambitions going in. I was thinking, well, you top 25 isn't unreasonable. But then you quickly readjust your goals as things develop. So I think that race ended up, I think, with the conditions turned out to be very much that. Who could hold it together for the longest and maybe not get affected by the weather as bad as the others.
Right, Kev, I don't want to keep you too much longer, but let's what's sort of in the pipeline going forward? You're now you're an assistant head. No, sorry, that's not correct, is it? Assistant head or deputy head? What's the
assistant principal? Yeah,
assistant principal. Yeah. So you're an assistant principal. You're a two-time Olympian. What's more important going forward, or are you confident that you can continue to sort of play both hands for a while yet to come?
You know, I'm still having a great time. I'm still enjoying it. Enjoying running. Enjoying school. Both are doing okay. And as long as either or doesn't kind of fall by the wayside in any way, then I'll continue for a while. But very much I do consider myself to be an educator first, and I think that's where my priorities lie moving forward. But for now, I'm having a great time. Still ran home from school today in the dark, by the way. Remember a head torch?
Yeah,
the cops went back apparently.
Yeah.
So I got caught out today. I was leaving school and was like, oh, I can't go through the normal path that I go because it's alongside of a river and it's pitch black out. So so I'm still enjoying it, having a great time, and hoping to run a marathon either early spring or late spring, depending on how I get back from a little bit of illness I had.
So when you now come to plan your races, is it a completely different situation and you're now dealing with agents? Are you talking money? Are you going to the place that's sort of offering the biggest perks, or is that still just not on your radar?
It's if I'm being honest, it's probably not much on my radar, to be fair. I know there's opportunities out there to work with various different people, and I have some people making calls and sort of help me out to get in the races, but largely no, it's not really on my radar. I can't commit to the sort of things that a lot of races or brands and stuff would want in terms of, you know, visiting places and being there early to do the promotional stuff. And so it's very much as we were, with the odd little perk and stuff thrown in around that.
And that's not something that you think you're going to look back on and go, oh, I missed out on that professional side. I missed out on the opportunity to be a professional athlete.
No, not in terms of everything that comes with the sort of shoe deals and stuff that come with it. No, not really, because I think in terms of my approach to the athletics, I think it's always, I've been professional in the last sort of 4 or 5 years in terms of things I do. And I think it becomes more of a state of how you approach your training at the right times, etc., rather than what shoes you can cop for free. And so it's very much become about doing the right things at the right time, enjoying the sport and being professional that way, rather than necessarily the professionalism that comes with shoe contracts and appearance fees.
Yeah, no, that's great. A couple more maybe quicker questions before we wrap up. Making an Irish team is much harder than it was sort of maybe even 3, 4, 5 years ago. Is that sort of something that you're consciously aware of now, that simply running fast might not be enough just to get you on the team these days?
I think it's, and why? I think it's absolutely brilliant. I remember sitting down and talking after 2016 Olympics and saying, I hope we're fighting hard to make the team in 2020, 2021 as it turned out, because it'll be a good thing. It means that Irish athletics is improving and we're seeing a lot stronger performances from Irish sport. And we've got so many good athletes in Ireland now at the minute that you're right, making any of the teams is going to be a big challenge. But I look forward to those challenges. And like I said earlier, I'm chuffed when people run fast and when people run well, because it can only mean improvements for our sport and certainly our sport within Ireland. So yeah, it's much harder to make the team. People are more aware of what it takes to make teams and how hard they need to train and how sensibly they need to train. So it's great for us. It's great for the sport.
Talk to us about shoes.
I knew that was coming.
In what way do you I think
they're you know what I mean.
I think it's a question now that has been around for a long time. I think the first sort of thing was, I didn't realize, I don't know if you guys did, but how many guys were wearing the original 4%, for example, in Rio.
Yeah,
and how they featured pretty much in every championship through from there, and without really it being available to everyone. And I think at that stage, it's a little bit of a different piece of technology and a different question than it is now. I think the shoe's available to everyone.
Yeah, it's almost a non-issue now, isn't it? They want to try and make it something.
Absolutely. The shoes are there. Technology's moved on. We embrace it in a host of other sports, cycling, swimming, etc. And I think it's very much, it's here. It's not going to go away, and it's here to stay. So I think there's going to be a misconception that just having the shoes is enough. And a lot of people are going to fall into that trap where they put the shoes on and, you know, the rest is history. It does the job for them. You very much got to train sensibly. You got to train hard. You got to do the work. And then, you know, you might find that the shoes give you a little bit of a benefit.
So, but there seems to be two common thoughts on that, on now sort of why they're good. One, there's kind of just an obvious, they make you run faster. Like for whatever reason that is, and to whatever degree, is widely up for debate. And then the other argument is that it's allowing athletes to train harder because there's a bit less pounding on the body. Do you sort of have any view on either of those?
It's difficult in terms of the pounding on the body. I wouldn't train in a carbon shoe. I'm not sure if people do or don't. I'm not really sure, but I feel like the benefits come from training not in the shoes, in terms of your body adjusting, adapting to the stress, to the road, sort of all that sort of stuff that we talked about briefly earlier when we said, and you know, you ran a lot, therefore you became quite strong and robust. And I think that's important. It's important not to miss that sort of phase of training. I do know people talk about how they'll do a session in them and then the next day they don't feel quite as beat up as they would have done beforehand. But I think you then need to cross over into the physiology of it and say, well, if you're running the same splits in the shoes and they are making you run faster, then are you getting as much of an aerobic benefit out of it, or are you having to run quicker to get the same benefit? And then the risks kind of increase with that as well. So mechanical risks, but it's a difficult one in terms of whether or not they do save the legs from pounding. But you see people certainly putting more marathons together. So you'll see a lot of the guys who ran in Tokyo have run a second marathon already, or are planning to run one in the next sort of 3 or 4 weeks. So I'm not sure how possible that would have been without the help of the technology. So, and that's only a benefit for the fans, for people out there, because we're seeing athletes running, Bashir Abdi, for example, running, you know, at the Olympics and then going and running a European record.
Yeah.
So, which is great for athletics and great for the fans. So technology, if we embrace it in that way and we sort of say, well, it's allowing our favorite athletes to get back out and perform again, then it can't be a bad thing, can it?
Do you not class yourself as one of those people's favorite athletes?
I'm one of the obscure athletes. I think people don't know too much about it, and I'm okay for that as well.
Right, Kev, thank you so much for joining us. It's been an absolutely fascinating insight into all kind of assets of your life and your training. Callum, is there anything else you want to know, or you anything you want to say to wrap up?
I just wanted to say, are you sure you're working full time? You're definitely working full time. No, that was really interesting, like Gavin said. Nothing else I want to ask, really. Conscious of keeping you late in the evening, but that was really, really great. Thanks for coming on.
No, anytime. Thanks for having me. I'm off to get a cup of tea now.
Nice. Kev, I know you've already said like you're not doing the whole kind of professional side, but I know you are on social media, aren't you? Like, if people want to sort of follow along with your journey, is there anywhere they can go to?
Yeah,
you can support what you're up to.
Absolutely, you can follow me along on Twitter or Instagram, and I do try to put up a bit more of my training and stuff on there. So you can more than welcome to follow along and join the madness.
Where can people find you?
So you can find me Instagram at KevRunning2016 and the same on Twitter.
At KevRunning2016.
2016.
Good man. Thanks a lot, Kev. Really appreciate you coming.
Amazing. Thank you very much for having me.
Cheers, mate. Yeah.
Cheers.
Thanks, Kev.
Thank
you.
Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Conversations About Running, the podcast by Running Trips. Running Trips are the people behind Kenya Experience, the ultimate running holiday in Attend Kenya, and Training Focus Camps, a weekend of high-performance coaching for runners of all levels in the UK. To learn more about Kenya Experience or Training Focus Camps, check out our website at www.runningtrips.co.uk or follow us on Insta by searching for Running Trips Official. Thanks for listening and happy running.